All right. We want to say a special thanks to Kyle and Lacey for being willing to share their story with so much honesty, and how grateful we are that we can be in a congregation where we can have that kind of dialogue and that openness and their willingness to share. Just a great opportunity for us. And as we, over the next few weeks, are challenging ourselves with thinking through, with honesty and integrity, those kinds of issues, and what is cultural and what is biblical and what is God's response for us. Before we jump in, though, let's take just a quick moment and celebrate as best we can. I'm not the best celebrator, so we're working on it. But here's what we want to acknowledge on this weekend. It was back in 08, so we're gathering maybe 6 years now. We launched in February of 08 our Powdersville campus with about 70 folks. And so this weekend, they will be moving into and are in at our 915 service out there, their new building, which is our new building. And so how excited we are to be able to enjoy it now. They have two services this weekend, and it is beautiful. I was out there most of the day on Friday and just looking around and acting like I was helping out is just beautiful, and what a great opportunity to be in the community. You got to fake it, you know, act like you're doing something. I want to give a special thanks to Jeff Randolph on our staff, who has carried the weight and responsibility for this last year of making sure that this building was built on the Grace Church side of things and working with contractors. He has three jobs. He's a developer, he's a professor at Clemson, and he works about half the time on our staff. And we are so grateful that he can bring things in under budget and get great deals for us and make all this happen. So we're really grateful. If you've built anything, you know how difficult that is. And he built a bunch of things for us and is doing a lot at the same time. And so how grateful we are. And then to the principal, Dr. Ferguson at Powdersville High School. It's not every principal at every high school that can go into this kind of a two-year venture and figure out where you can compromise and where this situation can make your high school better and make the church better. And he has been great to work with and has been really flexible and honoring and helpful. And we sought to be a blessing to them. And I think he's communicated that to us, that we have been. And so we will be forever grateful of the great contribution that Powdersville High School made to us, and we hope that they feel the same way. And I think about just starting with the small core group and how that church has grown and that congregation continues to flourish, and we're really just thrilled with that. And I think about some of the couples that are from other campuses that helped launch it. So Will and Tony Boughton were just one of a few couples from downtown, and Tim and Katina Shirley live in Fountain Inn. They helped launch that campus and now back at their respective campuses, and just what a great thing it has been, and we're really excited about it. So there's this local piece. If you're new to our church, that's very local. It's in the local community. And then there's this larger piece where we kind of share resources and we work together. And so God's really honoring it. Grab a Bible, turn to Genesis chapter 3. Easy book to find, first up in the order, right? Page 4. If you don't have a Bible, there should be one in the pew in front of you if you're downtown, or the seat in front of you at Pelham, or they're handing them out at our other campuses. Genesis chapter 3, we'll look at it in just a second. What we tried to introduce last week, we tried to open the door on a few ideas. And the main one is this, is that sexuality in general and sex in specific, this is a discipleship issue for the believer and for the church. And that we should not be ashamed to talk about what God has created. Is that this is not something that's bad or belongs compartmentalized over here in a category. In fact, that's part of the problem. Is that as a discipleship issue, we want to consolidate all the issues of life underneath the authority and the headship of Jesus, because he is calling, ironically enough, for our freedom. Is that when you enjoy the freedom of the world, ironically enough, it winds up landing in some form of slavery. And then when you willingly choose to make yourself a doulos or a slave of the Creator, then it winds up landing you in an arena of freedom. It is one of the great counterintuitive ideas for those who want to follow Christ. There's some differences between men and women. There are some unique challenges for each, but there's some common challenges as we talk about sexual integrity on this weekend. The church, we were saying this, has a tendency to hide or not have a voice. And then on top of that, then there seems to be a lack of clarity and a lack of truth and a lack of power. So when we listen to Kyle and Lacey speak, we're like, you can feel some weightiness. You can feel some power in what they're communicating and how they're living. Does it make them perfect? Not, no need to exalt them or make it more than what it is. But you can feel the weightiness and the strength and the power. But that comes through some clarity that they received and some choices that they made to follow truth rather than instinct or emotion or their own gut feelings about things. Right? So there is some clarity and truth that brings some weightiness and some power. I could give a lot of statistics about the culture in a moment like this. We can beat up on the culture and we can show. I mean, but you don't, I don't have to do that. You can Google that. So give me some statistics about this. Give me some statistics about that. You can read the paper. You can watch the news. You can get all the statistics you want. The issue for us is we got to deal with us first. Is that we are a church full of folks who are confused. And as James would say, who have been blown about by every doctrine of our culture. That we are marred and we are disfigured in many, many ways. And there is time for healing to come to us as a congregation, right? We are replete with folks who are struggling right now in their sexuality or have struggled and trying to recover from some of that. Jesus came for you. Jesus came for us. When you walk into a congregation, you look around, you think, man, look at all these people who have it together. Let me just say, what you see is probably not reality in the way that you're viewing it. But if you do see something that is redemptive, that is golden, that is beautiful about what's happened in someone's life, just know that is the same work that Jesus is wanting to do in you. That is the same work that the Spirit is wanting to do in you. I just want to read, to recapture our origin from Genesis 3. Now, we're not going to deal with this in a technical way. If you want to see a technical treatment or more technical, more developed treatment of Genesis 1, 2, and 3, then the first time we did this series, A Theology of Sex, then you go back and you grab that off our website and it'll be more developed in these three chapters. Or you get into an Azair study or you get into a men's roundtable study. We deal with it in a more developed way. That is not our purposes in this series at this time. But in verse 6, I wanted to recapture the origin of kind of where our problems started. It says the woman was convinced. What she's convinced of? She's been in a dialogue with Satan about what she's missing out on, and he's offering her a great opportunity. So when as he makes his argument, she becomes deceived, she gets convinced. She saw that the tree was beautiful for fruit. It's the only thing that God said you can't have, but yet they want it. And she didn't want to miss out, neither does the man, and so they're both going to partake. How beautiful it was and how its fruit looked delicious, and she wanted the wisdom it would give her, so she took from the fruit, she ate it. Then she gave some to her husband, who should have been far, far away or getting involved. He was doing neither. He's tagging along. He's with her. He ate it too. Verse 7. At that moment, their eyes were open, and they suddenly felt shame at their nakedness, and so they sewed fig leaves together to cover themselves. That's a big idea for us, so kind of circle that. They covered themselves. Then verse 8. When the cool evening breezes were blowing, the man and his wife heard the Lord walking about in the garden, and so they hid from the Lord. Another big idea. They hide from him. Hiding from each other, hiding from him. They hide from him among the trees, as if he didn't create the trees. Right? It's not logical. I can't account for it. Verse 9. Then the Lord called to the man. He goes, "Where are you?" He said, "I heard you walking in the garden, and so I hid. I was afraid because I was naked." And so here's what theologians call the fall. All right? There is creation, and now there is the fall. This is the moment where we in humanity chose to turn from God to our selfish ways. We became lifted up in our pride, and we made a decision to serve ourselves and exalt ourselves to become like God Most High. This is when we chose this. And you're thinking, wait a minute, I wasn't there. That's debatable. But let's just say you weren't there, that Adam is your representative in this moment. And you go, I'm not sure I want him as my representative. Well, you have to remember this, is that though he was born in perfection, he chose sin. You were born into sin. And all you and I have done since we have been born is validate his decision. Every time we sin, we confirm that we are with him, that we are in him, that we would have and we do make the same choices that he makes. This choice to turn from God and turn towards ourselves brings judgment. Judgment on creation, judgment on the woman, judgment on the man. We deal with that in a more thorough way at other times. But here is a few ideas that I think are important coming out of this. And we have a slide for this, just a few big ideas. The first one is that sex is primarily powerful now because of the fall. Here's what we would say, and some of the theologians in the room are going to struggle a little bit. It's okay, grant me some grace, it'll land in a little bit, okay? But the idea is this, is that before the fall, sex was primarily good, And then it was primarily powerful. But now it's just primarily powerful. It might be good or it might be bad. Don't really know yet. So we have folks in the room who've had really wholesome, pure relationships, and they enjoy the benefit of the bonding that comes from a great sexual relationship that's been ordained by God. We have other folks, she was abused when she was 12 years old, and now she carries that into her marriage, and she's 50 years old, and she carries those wounds even now, right? Why? Because sex was used in a harmful way, but still powerful. Can't get around that. So sex is primarily powerful. And here's what we're saying, is that when humanity falls, sex, sexuality, and intimacy fall with it. Right? We're not compartmentalized in the fall. When we fall, everything falls with us. When life becomes broken, it's not just in abstract terms. It's in very specific, clear terms. So our sexuality is broken. Manhood is broken. Masculinity is broken. Femininity is broken. Sexuality is broken. Understanding of gender is broken. How we relate to each other as sexual beings, all of that gets broken. So intimacy and sexuality and even sex are broken. Second idea is that we are hiders. This is what we learn. We're hiders. Is that as soon as everything has been, they at the end of chapter 2, and they were naked and not ashamed. In other words, there's no sin, there's no vulnerability, there's no feeling of exposure. We are connected to each other and we're connected to God. But as soon as sin reigns, now there is that exposure. And so they cover themselves with fig leaves, so they are hiding from each other. She is terrified of him, and he is now terrified of her. So we're going to cover up, we're going to hide. And then they're going to hide from God. There's this distance now that I feel. There is this threat that I feel. There is this lack of comfort that I feel. And so I have to distance myself. And here's what's true in our arena right now. Is that so many people on all of our campuses and all of our services will come in with their heart guarded this weekend because of sexual sin. They intuitively feel the distance between them and God, and that God is not safe because they have been involved in sin. Now, it's true of all sin, right? It's true of all sin. But it's magnified around sexual sin because of the intimacy issue of worship and the intimacy issue of sexuality. So there are so many of us on this weekend that are hiding, and every weekend that are hiding, we feel more separate from God than we already are because of our sin, because of what we're going through. And the third idea is that isolation, it is now the new motivator. It is the new normal. Is that it is a stark new reality for Adam and Eve to go from being in fellowship, in community, completely connected from an intimate level, to being in isolation and being alone. But that's not new for you. You and I were born into that. We were born with the idea that when you meet a stranger, you don't tell them everything you think and feel and know. That when you go out in public, you put clothes on. Right? We were born with all of these ideas. We have these basic instincts of fear rooted in our isolation. And here's what's important for us to know. Is that that sense of aloneness and isolation is a motivator. It motivates us to get away from it. To find things that we can grab and bring into our life to dull the pain or to eliminate those feelings of aloneness or isolation. And so as one counselor told me a long time ago, he says, we are scrambling to fill the void. And we will fill it with all kinds of sin. It just so happens that sexual immorality is a great accessible idol to deal with the acute pain of lost intimacy, or the feeling of being alone, or the feelings of being isolated. Is that sexual immorality in any form, whether it's flirting, whether it's pornography, whether it's having actual sex, whether it's an emotional affair, dressing immodestly, whatever, there it can be used in many, many forms to dull the pain and to deal with that feeling of isolation, right? That it becomes extremely accessible. So that's why we got 50 pictures this week texted in of men standing in front of Hardee's taking selfies going, right? They're hilarious, right? So you're so funny. I just want to say, you found a way to dull the pain. We're having a great time with it. You know, I know you didn't eat there. You just stood out front and you took your picture. I got it. Jeremiah 2 puts it this way, 2:13. He's talking about the idolatry of Israel. They have abandoned me, the fountain of living water, and they have dug for themselves cracked cisterns that hold no water at all. He says, here's what they've done. He goes, in an effort to have life, to have water to drink, they've dug, instead of getting life and water from me, they followed after other idols, after other gods. And it's like building your own cistern, which cistern is, we don't use them that much. They're kind of coming back, where you store water. All right, every house had its own cistern, so you store water there. He goes, it's like building a cistern, but it's cracked at the bottom. And so our idolatry and our sexual immorality, as it manifests itself, just like idolatry, he says, it's a cracked cistern. He goes, you can keep drinking from it. You can keep trying to fill yourself with it. You can keep pursuing it. He goes, but it's cracked. He goes, it will constantly leak out. He goes, you will not find fulfillment in it. All right, so that's where we come from. All right, now let me get you to the passage that we want to talk about for a few minutes. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, page 687. This is what I really came to tell you, right? I had to tell you that so we can tell you this, that you have an understanding of how broken we are and how broken sexuality is. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, page 687. You have to understand this about Corinth. You go, 2,000 years old. They're ancient, they're dumb, they don't know anything, and they're primitive. Okay, that would not be a fair description. The city of Corinth is close to the water. Lots of sailors kind of come and go. It's known as a very corrupt, even by Gentile standards in the New Testament, a very corrupt city, but heavily influenced with Greece, obviously, Greek culture, heavily influenced with Roman culture, heavily influenced with Egyptian culture. So there are folks from all influences from all over the world that influence Corinth. It is very progressive. So more progressive than we are. More open philosophically, more open politically, more open theologically, sexually, morally, in every way, it is more progressive and more open than our culture is right now. Okay, that's my assessment, but I don't think it's hard to prove, right? There are, if you want to worship, there are some male gods like Hermes and Apollos that you can worship there, but the premier god is the goddess Aphrodite, the goddess of love. And so if you want to worship Aphrodite in Corinth, though the temple is in ruins by the time that Paul comes along, there are still 1,000 cult prostitutes. And that is how you engage in worship of Aphrodite in Corinth, as you engage a temple prostitute. It is very progressive in its thinking. It is very open, very pluralistic. And so anything that he says in this context, we're like, man, that's a biblical standard he's holding out. It would not have been well received. You go, well, I mean, our culture, you know, is crazy. And they were probably more biblical in their thinking. They were not, right? They're more, let's say, liberal theologically in their thinking. Verse 12, let's look at a few ideas. He says, you say, talking to the Corinthians, he's having to take their arguments in one letter and then return their arguments back to them and address them, right? And they make some good arguments. You have to deal with them. You say that food was made for the stomach and stomach for food. This is true, though someday God will do away with both of them. Here's their argument. Paul is saying, the way you were living, now not non-Christians, but Christians. He says, the way you are living as Christians is not right. You are not honoring God with your body. The sexual immorality that you're involved in Corinth, you're copying your culture, and you're supposed to be living for God, which is going to be different than your culture. And their argument back to him was, hey, God made food for the stomach and stomach for food. And you're like, I don't get it. Here's their argument. I'm hungry. I see food. I eat it. It's what God created. So their argument back to him is, I want to have sex. I see a woman, so I have sex. I don't care who she is. God created this. God created her. No problem. God created corn. He created the stomach. You eat corn, right? He goes, God created this sexual drive. He created her. He created him. So it's really very simple. And is that a good argument? It actually is a fairly good argument, right, in their context. And that's why he says, this is true, though someday God will do away with both of them. There's no future for the stomach, spiritually speaking. He goes, but you can't say that our bodies were made for sexual immorality. He goes, you can say the stomach was made for steak. You can say that. But you cannot say that the body was made for immorality. Though that can be done, you can take the body and you can subject it to sexual immorality, but that was not God's design. So he acknowledges there is a principle that they make, but it is misapplied. Verse 13, or halfway through. He goes, they, the bodies, they were not made for immorality. They were made for the Lord. There's a higher calling on the body. Not just what? Not just the soul. Right? And that's where they get confused, and even our culture a little bit too. And the Lord cares about our bodies, which we're going to see why in just a second. And God will raise us from the dead by his power, just as he raised our Lord from the dead. He says, there is actually a future for your body. It is not just earthly for you to use up and corrupt while you're here, hanging on to the idea that your soul is good. He goes, your body. He goes, God has a future for your body. And so we see in 13 that this is an authority issue. This is an authority issue. That your body was made for the Lord. Verse 15. This is a little complicated. Just give me 2 seconds. We'll pull it apart. The next few verses. Don't you realize your bodies are actually parts of Christ? Okay? My body is part of Christ. He's spiritual. I'm physical. It's a stretch. All right? Should a man take his body, which is part of Christ, and join it to a prostitute? The idea is never. Some of you are like, well, obviously not a prostitute. Here's what you got to understand. Is that he's not using prostitute in a diminutive way. He's not pulling at the bottom of the bottom rung of the ladder going, prostitution's the worst thing. He's actually pointing to it as the best thing. A casual sexual relationship would be the worst thing. He goes, temple prostitution is an opportunity to worship. He's not pulling out the weakest link in the chain and highlighting it. He's pulling out the strongest link in the chain. He's like, he's making the case, if you can't have sex with a temple prostitute, if that's sexual immorality, then all other forms are immoral too. So he's not actually pulling at the weakest chain, he's pulling at the strongest part of it. He goes, should a man take his body, which is part of Christ, and join it to a prostitute? He goes, never. And don't you realize that a man joins himself to a prostitute, he becomes one body with her. For the scriptures say, the two are united into one. Two are united into one. A quote from Genesis chapter 2. We find out now, they're one flesh, united into one. That is a physical, mental, emotional, and even sexual idea in Genesis. Now here's what he's saying. He's saying that spiritually, this man or woman is connected to Christ. And if they find themselves in an immoral relationship with someone, they are dragging Christ into that sin and that immorality because he is connected to them spiritually. Now, here is one of the cool observations. When you meditate on this, you'll see it clearly. Is that if Christ is related to this person's body spiritually, but they have only a physical interaction with another person, then Christ wouldn't be drawn into it. Because Christ is a spiritual relationship, this is a physical relationship. He says, but no, that's not what happens. You're connected to Christ, you're in this immoral relationship with this person, because you've drug Christ into this sin with you. So what does that mean? That the sexual engagement, the sexual activity, it is not just physical, it is also spiritual. There's a spiritual component to sexuality, right? And there are hundreds of applications and lots to think about on that. But if I'm spiritually connected to Christ, and then you're in this relationship with this person, you're connecting him because it is not merely physical what we do with our bodies. There's a spiritual component to it. So whether you are flirting and emailing, texting, making out, having sex, you are dragging Jesus into what you are doing. So that is a huge observation for us to think about, particularly next week when we talk about marriage. But verse 17. The person who is joined to the Lord is one spirit with him. And then he gives direction for the first time. Run from sexual sin. So there's some direction for us that we're going to think about, talk about, unpack a little bit. No other sin is so clearly affects the body as this one does. So there's an observation. Sexual immorality is a sin against your own body. What's he mean? We get to talk about that over the next few weeks. 19, don't you realize that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit? Second big idea that lives in you, given to you by God. You do not belong to yourself, for God bought you at a high price, so you must honor God with your body. He gives us two reasons, two things to think about here. The first one is, and we have this too, is that the first idea is that sexual immorality is a sin against your own body. You go, how so? How is this a sin? Because we know that it's physical. We know there's an emotional piece. That's not component. That's not hard to see. Now we've learned that there's a spiritual piece. He goes, this is very, very powerful, and it backfires on you. It's a child who takes a stick and puts it into the fire because they love fire. And they get the end of the stick, they get it really hot. And then they take it out, and it's all glowing. And they're so fascinated by it. And they reach around, and they're holding the cold end, and then they grab the hot end. And you're like, what are you doing? You're like, I love fire. You used to love fire. Now you have burnt yourself. I try to tell you, glowing equals hot. It's so fascinating. But it is a mistake. It is a sin. It is a transgression that winds up burning you. And there's a lot to unpack, which we'll talk about over the next few weeks. But let me just break it into two simple categories. Here's what you'll see. The wound that comes from sexual sin, where you sin against your own body, it has a number of ideas to think about. But very simply, you could put in two categories, is that some folks, they get wounded because of the immorality in their life. And it makes them feel an intense amount of vulnerability. So now they have to be self-protective. They have to be self-protective. They are scared. They are concerned. They really will struggle to connect in intimate ways because they are so wounded and they carry such shame and such guilt that they have a hard time connecting, and it's self-protective. They have to be withdrawn, right? And then the other end of that extreme is they don't get wounded in that way. They get wounded in another way where they become calloused. And now intimacy is difficult because now sex is just something that you just do. It doesn't have an emotional or spiritual component. It's just completely physical. And you can just move from person to person to person, person after person after person. Your heart is calloused. You don't really feel. So there's not a lot of hurt, not a lot of pain. And so in this situation, hyper vulnerable, tons of pain. In this situation, calloused heart, no pain. In one, you feel too much pain for the wrong reasons. And in this one, you feel no pain for the wrong reason. No, ultimately, that person will. So it comes this idea where you're like, you're never told to run from lying. You're told, don't lie and don't steal. But you're never told to run from it. Because you can lie to someone and not do this kind of damage to your soul. All sin is damaging. I get that, right? But there is some damage that you can do to your soul here that is very unique. And then the second idea is that it is a sin, not just against your own body, but it's a sin against God. So here's the argument that gets made to me, right? We're created by God. We've fallen into sin. We chose sin. We've been bought back, redeemed out of that, if we're believers, because we're created by God, fell into sin, rebellion, bought back. He sent his spirit to live inside of us. And he says, now, because I have redeemed you from the pit, you had no future. I've given you a future. You're to honor me with your future. You're to honor me, right? That's the idea. But here's what I'll get sometimes. People will say to me, look, I've never slept with anybody else but this person. We're engaged. We're going to be married. And we're going to be married forever. So I'm not hyper-vulnerable person who's been wounded in that way. And then I'm not hyper-calloused person who's been wounded in that way. There's not been immorality before this person. We are committed to being together. We're going to be married next year. And so we're in this relationship now, and we are fine with it. We're good. And that's part of Kyle and Lacey's story. We're good with this, right? But we're going to get married. That is true. All right, all that kind of makes sense. And they're going, so what is the practical reason why I'm not harming myself? So what's the practical reason that we should not be in this kind of relationship before we're married? Well, here's what I would tell you. There's not one. Right? There's not. We don't have to give a practical reason for everything. God says, I created you. I called you. I saved you. I created marriage. And I gave it to you, and I have created this and given it to you. Now I expect you to follow me and honor me and live in a way that glorifies and honors me. It is not about everything being practically beneficial to you. And someone says, but this is what I want to do. It makes me happy. And God says, it's not about what makes you happy. God says it's actually about what makes me happy. Unfortunately, we have raised a couple generations of Christians who are saying, it is God's job to honor me. And God is saying, I think we got something backwards. God is saying, I think it's your job to honor me. I am giving you some rules and some principles that are healthy for you, that will make your life better, that will create enjoyment and fulfillment. That is very much true, that sin is destructive. I want to keep you from sin so you don't destroy yourself. But the other side of it, there are times when it's not just about sin and destruction. It is about what does it look like to live a life that honors the God that created you, that screams out to the cosmos, hey, I serve the true King. I live in a way that honors and glorifies His direction and His rulership over me, not my own rulership. I'm not the king. I don't get to rule over me. I don't get to make those decisions. God is the one who rules over me. He makes those decisions. And so with that, He gives this direction, is that you should run or flee from sexual sin. Now, we will talk, not as much practical on this weekend, but over the next few weeks, we'll talk very practical about what that looks like for singles, for marrieds, in a parenting context. What is healing from sexual sin and immorality? What does that look like? We get to discuss some of that. So the issue of, but we got to be clear, because we live in a culture and we have a congregation who we're not always clear on what sexual sin or sexual integrity might be, what it might look like. How we get there is another issue, but what it might look like. So let me just give you my definition for sexual integrity. Now, before I do, some of our staff are going to faint, all right? I have not told them what the definition was going to be because we have really great definitions, but those definitions don't communicate that well from stage. They're very long. They're very complicated. I get confused and lost. And so they're really great for small group discussion, but not for big mass communication. So I'm going to give you my definition. Please don't hold the rest of our staff accountable when you hear this, okay? Great. Because they are going to be completely ashamed of me and distance themselves. It is this. Is that sexual integrity, under how we are communicating, I'm communicating right now, is that you are directing all of your sexual energy and activity towards your spouse. Is that you are directing all of your sexual energy and activity towards your spouse. I know, it raises bunches of questions, right? And we'll deal with them. Now, so for some folks, they're going, wait a minute. Sexual activity and energy. Yes, I'll give you some examples. But here's the premise. Is that marriage is the context of commitment in which intimacy flourishes. Right? So that's what I mean by spouse. It's in the context of a marriage. And it is that the safety and the security of that kind of commitment that intimacy flourishes. And when intimacy flourishes, so does a fulfilling sexual relationship. Right? That's the idea. And you go, well, I know some marriages that aren't very fulfilling. Right. Just because one oven is broken doesn't mean, and you can point to things that are broken, doesn't mean that the concept and the principle is broken. There are applications of that everywhere that are broken. But the principle is still the same. It is still right. It is still true. Is it is in that kind of commitment, what we call marriage with a spouse, where all sexual energy and activity is supposed to be channeled and directed. It is about the development of intimacy. You go, wait a minute, I'm single. I don't have a spouse to direct my sexual energy to. Okay, that is a good point, which we get to unpack further in a couple weeks. But here's what it means. It means that the energy that you have, you do not translate it into overtly sexual energy. You leave it untranslated and you push it towards work and ministry and relationships and healthy relationships. The energy is still there on the feminine side, on the masculine side, but it gets channeled into work, it gets channeled into ministry, and it gets channeled into healthy expressions of relationships around you. Okay? So I know there's a bunch of people that are really upset, but it's okay. I promise. We'll get through it. Some illustrations or some applications of sexual integrity or sexual immorality. And here's what I'm going to say. I'm going to list out a few. I'm not saying that these are all the same. Nobody's saying that. That this is the same as that because they're in the same list. Everything seems to be on some form of a spectrum as far as the severity of damage that it can bring into your own life, into your soul, into your heart, okay? But here's what I'm going to say. With that definition of directing all sexual energy and activity toward your spouse, so first one is flirting. Flirting with people that you're not married to, okay? An emotional connection that might come through media, which we have to be real careful with, might be over email, might be over the internet, who knows what it might be, all right? Sex before marriage. And we do have people all the time who come into our church, they're not trying to cover up the fact they're living together, they're like, hey, this is what we're doing. And so it's a great conversation to get to have. Sex outside marriage, adultery. I got a letter this week explaining to me, just reiterating, just how destructive adultery is for all the relationships, the children, the family, how painful it is. And everybody is close enough to it to kind of know. You've seen it. A homosexual relationship, that is broken sexuality. What psychologists call illicit contact, which means a physical relationship, which may not have intercourse, making out, a massage parlor, a strip bar. Pornography, you're like, well, how is pornography a sexual activity? It may not be. It may just be sexual energy that's misdirected. And what you've done is you've created a fantasy, most likely, although pornography is on the rise among women, with men, you've created a fantasy that no woman can live up to. Conversely, you go, well, this next one's not as bad. Maybe, maybe not, right? But a romantic novel. It does the same thing on the other side. So for not for all women, but for a lot of women, the reading of a romantic novel creates a fantasy and certain expectations and the channeling of sexual energy in a way that her husband can never live up to that, right? That was just a story. He doesn't have the time or the energy, the ability to live up to the fantasy that's been created in her head now. Modesty, I mentioned this last week, is that a woman can dress in a certain way that gets her attention, that makes her feel valuable, even powerful. That's a form of misdirecting sexual energy, taking it out into a place where it doesn't need to be. What we've termed as solo sex is the misdirection of that energy also. Now, here's what I know. I got singles. I'll get a bunch of emails this week, and it'll be a healthy dialogue. And I know you're screaming under your breath at me. But let me just say this. We're going to talk about it. Because here's the way singles generally feel. They generally feel like, though marrieds, all of that is clearly off limits for marrieds, but the rules are a little grayer for us, right? So like when I go to the beach with my children in the winter, and we just go down to see the ocean, they'll say, hey, can we walk into the water? I'm like, no, it's 40 degrees. It's cold. That doesn't make any sense. Don't do that. And they're like, no, we just will go in ankle deep. And then one of them would say, knee deep, just knee, we'll just go in. I'm like, all right, that's fine. But you know what's going to happen. One of them's going to come back covered, head to toe in water, right? And the idea is that we're not really going swimming. We're just going to get a little bit wet. And that is the idea for teens, college students, singles, a lot of times, is that the rules are much clearer for married folks, but for single folks, it's a little grayer. And I would say there's a couple places where it gets a little gray right before, on how you communicate, right before you get engaged is one of those times. But other than that, I really don't think it is. The question is, are you taking cues from your culture or are you looking at the scriptures? Because a lot of what we call dating, right, in our culture is actually, if you take and write on the board, here's dating is this and this and this and this, and you take that list and you lay it on the Bible, then it comes out, not dating, it comes out like marriage. So we got to say, when we're thinking about singles and dating, are we talking about marriage? Are we talking about dating? Are we talking about the culture? Are we talking about the Bible, right? Well, let me give you three big ideas to think about. These are just big categories I'm going to run you through real quickly that we'll come back to that gives just a few categories to think in. The first one is this, is that if you're going to walk in sexual integrity, the first one is that you're going to have to deal with your own spiritual life. You're going to have to deal with your own soul apart from your spouse if you're married, right? It can't be always about them. It's going to have to be about you. There is time in the Word and in prayer that you have to spend because we don't have time to develop it, but you see it all throughout the scriptures. The connection, some of the commonalities between spirituality and sexuality are real close because they both have intimacy at the base of them. A spiritual relationship is all about intimacy. And a sexual relationship is all about intimacy. So these things are closely related. And so if you are not feeding from the dialogue, your heart's not feeding from a dialogue with your Creator, then sexuality and sex and sexual immorality in particular becomes real easy to grasp to try to fill that intimacy need or that isolation need. So in the Word and prayer become really, really important in dealing with intimacy issues. Community and particularly confession and transparency is that you have to have a place where you can talk, where you can listen, where you can be heard, where you can confess some sin, where somebody or a group of people can know everything about you. Not everybody, but a few people can know everything that you think and feel. Because as those things come out into the light, they become easier to deal with. Particularly as you get older, which is a great irony. You would think as you get older, this gets simpler. Actually, men, midlife, women, now midlife, it actually gets a little more complicated. And you got to ask some questions. What drives you internally? What is driving you? So for men, let me just give some broad, sweeping overstatement, right? But 9 out of 10 men I sit with, this is easy, right? Is that there is a craving of affirmation that men want. It is what drives affairs across the board. Every single time. Not necessarily the one-night stand, but the actual affair. It is, for right or for wrong, the affirmation he did not feel like he could give from his wife. He found a woman who would give it to him. Every single time. It is a craving of affirmation. And here's the reality. Women may have work to do on this issue, but no woman can meet that deep need. And when I find a man who has a deep father wound, he is even more vulnerable to this idea, particularly as he gets older. And then women crave to be known and feel connected. And when they get weary that no one knows them, they don't feel connected to a man, then they will move in a direction that can be very, very unhealthy. Second idea is that you have to work on your marriage. And if you are a single person, then you have to work on your future marriage. But there has to be the allocation of resources that a man cannot quit pursuing. And there are thousands of reasons to stop pursuing your wife. But when you do, you are disobeying the God who created you. He gave you pursuing energy. You're not to channel it anywhere else. You're supposed to pursue her with it. Ladies, what does it look like for you in your relationship to be inviting? You're like, you don't know how difficult it is. I probably do, but we can work on that. But what does it mean for you to be inviting in your relationship? And a couple ideas right here. Is this because one of you thinks that your marriage is good does not mean that it is? I mean, how many times have we sat in a room with a couple in a counseling situation and one of them thought everything was fine and the other one did not? And then when you peel it back, you find out that the one who was not happy was trying to communicate that, maybe in subtle ways all along. But just because one of you thinks things are going well doesn't mean they are. And then I'm going to say something that's really going to get me in trouble. Is that there is a point of no return for a marriage. Jesus is all powerful and the gospel of redemption can heal anything. That is all true. But I'm talking about practically on this earth in time and space. There is a point when a marriage gets so frayed and there is so much bad blood, there is no coming back. Not because God is weak, but because we are. And we had a couple 3 years ago, or let's say 7 years ago, who sat through this series, who I saw the husband with his girlfriend at another church this summer. Because that's where because they were not honest. They did not deal with each other. They did not get outside help to help them. And so they sat through this same series, and now they're no longer together. She's with her high school sweetheart, and he's with his new girlfriend. And going to church. I called the pastor. I'm trying to make them care. I'm dealing with it. And then the third idea. Those two are more offensive. Last idea is a little more defensive. Just Matthew 29, Jesus said, you may have to go into drastic measures. You may have to save your life by plucking your eye out. It's a pretty good idea. Difficult, but there's some wisdom and difficult decisions we have to make. So around things like cell phone, you realize if you have a teenage son, is that he is not, this is not 30 years ago, where he has 2 magazines in a trash bag out in the woods that he and his friends go look at. He now carries a cell phone in his pocket with all the pornography in the whole world on it. All that there is in his pocket, right? And then for your daughter, her boyfriend does not have to sneak in the room late at night to comfort her and put her to bed. Is that without him coming in the bedroom, he can text her till the wee hours of the morning and comfort her and engage her and get her heart connected to him, right? Just texting. We're in a different world. We got things to think about. There's a transparency and accountability that needs to be renewed with media. And I tell the staff that I work with closely, I said, you walk in, you see something on my computer you don't like, then you rat me out. You see something that you think, you see anything in my behavior that is not, you think, I better not mess with Matt's desk, I better not get on his computer. No, you think something's wrong, you go through my desk, you look on my computer, you do what you have to do. There are things here that are more important than just my personal privacy. There shouldn't be anything in my life that I have to hide from you from, that I have to keep secret. We have to deal with how we interact with folks at work, the opposite sex, how we spend our time with them, how we travel. For some of us, you need to shut off a relationship that is just now taking off. There is something that has happened. There's a spark that needs to be dealt with. For some of us, you need to stop dating. You're in a relationship that is not redemptive, and God will not bring you the right person as long as you are in that relationship. Some of us need to evaluate the kinds of movies that we watch because of how they stir us, the kind of books that we read, the magazines we look at. And some of us, this is my deal for our church. There's too many people in our church spending too much time in bars. I cannot figure that out. You're like, well, I'm free to drink. You might be, or you might be getting enslaved to something. So what is that? What is it about our church that feels like I have the freedom to hang out in environments that do not glorify God and are not going to bring anything great into my life? They're only going to bring destruction. I cannot figure that out. And I'm looking at us going, Jesus is saying, I want you to be a redeemed people. And we do not always live that way. Hosea chapter 4 is very interesting to me. And you go read it later. He begins to talk to Israel about their sin and their idolatry. And when he gets to talking about their idolatry, he labels it as a form of prostitution and adultery. You're like, why is he calling idolatry adultery? Why does he do that? Because it is that personal to him. And you're thinking, well, my sin's not that personal. I mean, I'm good with it. I'm good with a holy God, and I keep my sin. But here's what I'm telling you. God's not good with it. He is deeply wounded and offended by our sin. Any form of it. We just happen to be talking about immorality right now. But any form of our sin, he considers it a personal, intimate betrayal of your relationship with him, that you have lied to him, you have betrayed him, you have turned your back on him. And that's me included, right? That's how he thinks of our sin. He did not create us for sin. He created us to live in a life that would glorify him. And this is not about being prudish and puritanical. This is not what this is about. God is not trying to keep us from the very thing that he created. He wants us in vibrant, dynamic sexual relationships in the context that he created called marriage with our spouses. He's not trying to keep anything from us. He's trying to guide us to it without us destroying ourselves in a sustained, healthy way. So the call on us as a church is that we need to repent. Is that for the sexual sin that we are involved in, whatever kind, man, woman, young, old, we need to turn away from our sin and turn towards him. And you're probably not going to be able to do that alone. You're like, well, God loves me. He forgives me. It is his grace and his kindness and his forgiveness that leads us to repentance, not leads us away from it. The fact that he hasn't destroyed us up to this point is not supposed to make me want to sin. It's supposed to make me think, goodness gracious, I'm lucky to be alive. It should lead me away from my sin. He's been so kind to me. Jesus died for you, took your place to take your sin so that you could live a holy life, so that you don't have to be enslaved to sin. This is what he calls us to. So repentance, that is what he wants for us. And this is the last difficult thing I'm going to say, is that if you say, I don't want to repent, I love my sin, there's a couple explanations for that. But the most prominent one is that you are not a Christian. Is that the gospel of Jesus is not real to you. If you say, I love my sin and I love my culture, then you are probably not a Christian. So let us help communicate the cross to you in a way that Jesus came to pay for your sin, to die on a cross, to take that judgment on himself for you so that you can live a new life and a different life. You go, well, that's a hard word. It is just the word. It's not a hard word. It is just the word. It's just what he has for us as believers. And we get to worship him now in gratefulness because he has been patient with us. Let's worship together. Father, would you not allow us to remain in our brokenness and in our sin? Is that you have been clear that it was our decision to turn away from you in Genesis. And then that has just grown. That kind of rebellion and sin has just grown through the centuries. Father, would you cause a new spirit to rise up in us now? and that we would see clearly our sin, as great as we think it might be or as small as we think it might be, that we would see it the way you see it, and that we would be convinced of our need to repent and to turn to you, that we would see the death that awaits us if we continue in our path, the wages that would be paid to us as a result of our sin, that we would see that clearly, and we would see the great benefit and the great blessing of what it means to turn and trust you and walk with you in humility. So, Father, would you open our eyes to ourselves, open our eyes to you now, and help us walk with you. We ask it in your name.